Turning Tides is an Antics Entertainment affiliate. You can find us on social media at The Turning Tides Podcast on Instagram, Facebook, and YouTube, and at Turning Tides Pod on Twitter. For more information, or if you're interested in sponsoring the podcast, please contact us at theturningtidespodcast@gmail.com. Thanks for listening.
Warning, this episode of Turning Tides contains depictions of war, violence, murder, racism, torture, and suicide.
Vidal Santiago Diaz was heading to work early on October 6th, 1950. Before he could enter his barber shop, the Salon Boricua, a black Buick filled with FBI agents appeared out of nowhere. The agents grabbed Santiago Diaz, threw him in the car, threw a canvas hood over his head, and sped away with their prize. He was taken to Ramey Air Force Base and ushered into the basement. The hood that had been placed over his head was removed, and a horrible odor began to pervade his nostrils. It was the smell of burning human flesh. He panicked for a moment, looked to the side, and saw a room which had a bloody skid mark leading up to it. He was pushed forward by the guards into a room where an American officer introduced himself. The officer made a short phone call, after which Santiago Diaz was led to another room, which had no furniture save for a copper wire bed frame with no mattress. He was forced to take off his clothes and lay down face first on the copper springs. The soldiers chained up Santiago Diaz's feet and legs and wheeled in a battery, which they connected to the bed frame with alligator clips. The electrical charge surged through his body. When he refused to speak, they dumped cold water on him to further exacerbate the electric shock torture. Santiago Diaz still would not break. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, "They strapped him to a wooden plank in an empty kitchen. One of the guards affixed a rubber tube to the sink tap as a soldier propped Santiago Diaz's head up against the sink. They wrapped his head in a rag, jammed a piece of wood between his lips, and told him that when he wanted to talk, he need only wiggle his fingers," unquote. He was then slowly drowned by the guards and soldiers present. They continued this until Santiago Diaz passed out. He awoke in total darkness and complete isolation. The guards would bring him a single cup of pea soup every day, and sometimes they would urinate in it. Now it was clear the guards were trying to starve Santiago Diaz into confessing. Whenever he attempted to get rest, insects and rodents would crawl on his bedsheets and under his clothes. One day, he attempted to get water from the faucet in his cell. He couldn't see, so he turned the tap on until his small cup, which held the daily soup ration, felt full. He raised the cup to drink, but instead of water, the legs of thousands of insects crawled on his face, across his eyes, and into his hair. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, "He heard someone screaming from far away, but it was him," unquote. Santiago Diaz was starting to lose his mind. He remained steadfast in his resolve and refused to cooperate with anyone at the Air Force Base. He was electrocuted and tortured to the point of unconsciousness multiple times, only to be revived with cold water and then shocked again. Every few days, more suspects were brought in for questioning and torture. The screams of those suffering were heard throughout the facility. This was intentional. In the few moments of silence, Santiago Diaz was able to swap stories with his fellow prisoners. One story left him disgusted. supposedly an older member of the Nationalist Party, shot a police officer and was interned at the facility. The guards intentionally starved the man for 2 weeks. One night, instead of the usual meager ration which was allotted to prisoners, the guards brought a giant plate of meat for the starving man. He quickly gobbled the whole thing down, and a guard asked him if he enjoyed devouring his own son. Another officer entered, grinning from ear to ear. He held up the severed head of the prisoner's son and asked, quote, "Did your son taste good?" unquote. The old man vomited, went into shock, and died of a heart attack in a matter of moments. In another instance, Santiago Diaz was brought to the infirmary where he was drugged by doctors and interrogated. Unable to coax a confession from him, the FBI informant Faustino Pacheco was brought in and attempted to reason with the drugged Santiago Diaz. He screamed at Pacheco that he, quote, "wasn't afraid of them, that he wasn't a traitor," unquote. In Washington, J. Edgar Hoover was coming to the realization that he had trouble on his hands in Puerto Rico. He blamed Luis Munoz Marin for all of it. He said, quote, "This drug addict wants to have a banana republic with U.S. air conditioning," unquote. He also told his agents on the ground to, quote, "arrest somebody, damn it," unquote. FBI surveillance against Pedro Albizu Campos was doubled. The street leading to his apartment was saturated with G-men. The police would break the traffic lights surrounding Albizu Campos' apartment building, giving them an excuse to stop and question anyone who they deemed suspicious. Due to the gag law, the authorities already had extra legal power to arrest and charge anyone who displayed the Puerto Rican flag or spoke against government rule. Santiago Diaz was half alive, and he was sure he was about to be shot for failing to cooperate with authorities. One night, he was hustled into a van. A hood was placed over his head, and he was transferred to another car. This car stopped in front of the Salon Boricua, and Santiago Diaz was dumped unceremoniously on the concrete. He was told 4 sets of FBI agents would be tracking his every step from now on. If he attempted to do something without their permission, they had orders to shoot him on sight. Little did the FBI know that the weapons they were desperately looking for were just next door to the salon in an empty apartment building. These weapons would be used to good effect in the next few weeks. Albizu Campos was scrambling to catch up with all that had happened. He learned about the arrests and the possible betrayal of several higher-up members of the Nationalists. He also learned that the U.S. Secretary of State, Lewis Johnson, advocated for the, quote, "complete liquidation," unquote, of the Nationalist Party and the arrest or execution of the leadership. Albizu Campos declared then and there to launch the armed revolution. He declared, quote, "no mas," unquote, and contacted party leadership to begin the planned uprisings. Several dozen haphazardly armed Nationalists were about to take the fight directly to the largest and most powerful nation on the face of the earth. This whole time, Munoz Marin had preached nonviolence and espoused his grand plans for the future. He called Puerto Rico, quote, "la patria pueblo," unquote, or the people's fatherland, in the hopes of rallying leftist elements in the country behind his banner. Additionally, he supported a change in the relationship between Puerto Rico and America, but had recently come out against independence for the island. Now he began espousing the old idea of the Estado Libre Asociado, or the Free Associated State. He claimed this would bring about a quote-unquote revolutionary change in the way America deals with its neighbor states. He argued with Washington elites for years to get the change cemented in the Puerto Rican Constitution. On July 25, 1952, the anniversary of America's quote-unquote liberation of the island, the Commonwealth status was proclaimed, and the Puerto Rican flag was raised to the same height as the American Stars and Stripes. So what exactly changed? Not much. Munoz Marin claimed that since the relationship between the island and the mainland was now, quote-unquote, consensual, Puerto Ricans would not need to reform the relationship any further. It was not anything close to the autonomous Dominion of Canada, but it was certainly not a state like Hawaii. This was a blessing at first, but in time it would prove a curse. Not being a state and not being independent meant that Puerto Rico relied on America more than ever. Puerto Ricans were not subject to the same constitutional protections as Americans. To this day, if you commit a misdemeanor on Puerto Rico, you do not have the right to be tried by a jury. Additionally, the island was not protected from economic shocks like a state would be. Furthermore, the inhabitants didn't have to pay federal taxes. This also meant that the federal government was under no obligation to provide Puerto Ricans with the full amount of their Social Security. In time, this would leave the island in an untenable position, in which it was forced to borrow money from Wall Street in order to pay the salaries of its civil servants and dispense welfare to the needy. It was a compromise which left PPD supporters happy, but few others. The reason for the unclear language was due to the fact that many Republicans in America and on the island wanted to leave the door open for statehood at some point in the future. Meanwhile, Munoz Marin said the Commonwealth status could serve, quote, as a model for a world federalizing more and more dissimilar cultures into less and less great fraternal units, unquote. American leaders were eager to change the status of Puerto Rico as well. The tenor of the times was advocating for decolonization, and many countries, Great Britain and France, for example, had already granted independence to vast swathes of their former colonial subjects. Puerto Rico was one of the few colonies left in the world, and it was a bad look for America. American diplomats had to present a report on their colony at every session of the UN. But since Puerto Rico was no longer a colony, this report fell by the wayside. Puerto Rico was also granted admission into the UN with their own delegate representing the island. Once more, the adjustment of Puerto Rican law was spurred by foreign war. The Korean War began on June 25, 1950, when the armies of North Korea began a surprise invasion of South Korea. In a matter of days, Seoul fell to communist forces. The UN met in an emergency session, and after the Soviet Union boycotted the meeting, the international body sanctioned the rapid deployment of armed forces to the peninsula. The United States was woefully unprepared for such a conflict, but General Douglas MacArthur made up for this fact with his determination and resoluteness. The pendulum quickly swung in the favor of the Allied forces when MacArthur boldly launched a surprise naval invasion of Incheon. Seoul was quickly liberated, and North Korean units were falling back in a headlong rout. In September of 1950, the 65th Infantry Regiment, nicknamed the Borinqueneers, landed in Pusan, South Korea, ready for action. As Allied armies made rapid progress, the regiment was first tasked with protecting Allied supply lines and battling with North Korean guerrillas behind the lines. General MacArthur's impetuousness, however, overextended his forces. This is when the People's Republic of China joined the war on the North Korean side. The PRC's army crashed through Allied positions and surrounded an entire Marine division around the chosen reservoir. The 65th were sent in to hold back the communist tide. They formed a cordon around the battered Marines and were amongst the last soldiers taken off the beaches when rescue and extrication finally came. As a result, the entire unit was commended for its bravery. By the war's end, Puerto Rican casualties were 3,500, of which 774 were killed in action. Arturo Morales Carrion says, quote, "One out of every 42 U.S. casualties was a Puerto Rican, and the island had one casualty for every 660 inhabitants, compared to one casualty for every 1,125 inhabitants of the United States," unquote. Several medals of honor were awarded to Puerto Ricans throughout the Korean War. Fernando Luis Garcia was a private serving in the 1st Marine Division. His unit was stationed well forward of other Allied positions when it came under attack. He was wounded in the initial fight and made combat inoperative, but he still endeavored to assist his comrades in holding the line. He rushed crucial supplies and extra grenades up to the front, risking enemy fire all the way. When an enemy grenade landed in his unit's trench, Garcia acted quickly and made the ultimate sacrifice. He threw his body on the grenade, saving numerous lives, but giving his own. Miguel A. Vera was fighting alongside his unit around Choroan. His company was supposed to be on the assault, but the unit had maneuvered itself into a deadly crossfire. The men were attempting to withdraw to a better firing position, so Vera volunteered to stay behind and hold off the enemy advance single-handedly. He fought throughout the night, but at some point he was killed. His sacrifice allowed his unit to safely extricate itself. The next morning, Allied units discovered his lifeless body, which was still in the same position, facing the enemy. Juan E. Negron was in Calma Eri, fending off a violent enemy attack. He took up the most vulnerable position on the extreme right of his unit. His men were forced back by heavy fire, but Negron refused to abandon his position. Instead, he delivered a devastating flanking fire on the enemy and single-handedly held off repeated assaults, as his men were able to withdraw unharassed. The next morning, Negron was found still fighting, with the bodies of 15 dead enemies lying around his foxhole. Dimencio Rivera and his unit were attacked by a huge enemy force around Changyongni. Rivera opened up on them with his automatic rifle until the weapon jammed, and he began fighting with his pistol and grenades. His citation reads, quote, "At one point, Private Rivera fearlessly crawled from his emplacement to engage an infiltrating enemy soldier in fierce hand-to-hand combat. With only the sound of footsteps and obscure shadows to guide his aim, Private Rivera held his position against tremendous odds, inflicting numerous casualties on the enemy until he found himself without ammunition of any kind, except one grenade. Private Rivera pulled the pin from his last grenade and calmly waited for the enemy to reach his position. As enemy troops leaped inside his bunker, Private Rivera activated the grenade with the full knowledge that it meant his almost certain death. When the debris from the explosion had cleared, friendly forces recovered a severely wounded Private Rivera and discovered the bodies of 4 dead or dying enemy soldiers surrounding him," unquote. He went on to live until 1967. Back on their native island, the Puerto Rican Revolution began on October 28, 1950. It started with a prison break, which had been planned for years by prisoners and was executed by a notorious murderer, Correa Cotto. In the initial riot, which quickly became a mass escape attempt, Cotto used the chaos to slit a guard's throat and then steal his keys and gun. Prisoners rallied to Cotto, who killed a second guard, wounded 4 others, and managed to escape. Alongside him, there were 110 prisoners who fanned out in all directions. This forced authorities to spend time tracking down escaped prisoners instead of cracking down on nationalist hideouts. The next day, J. Edgar Hoover dispatched 60 FBI agents to Puerto Rico in order to help quell the uprisings. As this occurred, the first armed confrontation took place between insular police and a group of nationalists in Peñuelas, who had barricaded themselves in their safe house. Approaching the door, police were met with a hail of gunfire, which they returned in kind. They attacked the house for almost an hour. At one point, Guillermo González Ubérez left the house, which was his only protection. For a moment, both sides watched horrified as Ubérez got within 20 feet of police. He then raised his pistol before being shot numerous times. A dozen bullets ripped into his face and body, but somehow he was still alive. Even more astounding, Ubérez did not hit the ground. He kept walking, and he was now within 10 feet of the police. He raised his pistol again. This time, Ubérez fell dead instantly when the police opened fire. The nationalists in the safe house were running low on ammunition. Three of them were dead, while six police officers were seriously wounded. In the end, the nationalists still in the house surrendered and were arrested. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, 2 days later, several farmers said they saw the ghost of Ubérez walking around in circles with a gun in his hand, as if patrolling the fields, unquote. Several hours after the showdown in Peñuelas, 18 armed nationalists stood before a Puerto Rican flag in Hayuai. They pledged their life to Puerto Rican liberty and set off, guns in hand. They arrived at the Hayuai police station intent on seizing the building. Their leader called out to the police, quote, "Surrender your arms and there will be no bloodshed today," unquote. The insular police responded with a fusillade of bullets from within the precinct. The nationalist leader was struck right away, but overall, the nationalists were getting the better of the engagement. A fire had started inside the precinct, and many police officers had to escape via a back balcony and seek refuge in a local church. By 2 p.m., the neighboring post office was also alight, while a selective service office was stormed as well. Nationalists went about destroying draft cards, official paperwork, and machines. Meanwhile, Blanca Canales was busy cutting all the telephone wires which led to town. After she had finished, she unfurled the Puerto Rican flag and proclaimed the start of the revolution and a new republic. On November 1st, America dispatched 10 P-47 Thunderbolt fighter planes from Ramey Air Force Base, where many nationalists were still being tortured. The planes dispensed bombs which weighed 500 pounds, while they attacked the city of Hayuai with heavy machine gun fire. The day after the bombing, National Guard troops occupied Hayuai. 4,000 heavily armed guardsmen initiated a curfew and arrested anyone found outside. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, "On Calle San Felipe and Avenida Vicens, the troops created firing lines with machine guns, mortars, carbines, and Garand semi-automatic rifles. They fired over 1,000 rounds of 30-caliber bullets into one mountain alone," unquote. On November 3rd, the Adjutant General of the National Guard reported that Hayuai had been quote-unquote pacified. Utuado was next. The town was a strategically important one, as its position in the island's center made it ideal for spreading revolution. Besides its central location, Utuado was a transportation hub. Whoever controlled the town could easily move troops to any position on the western half of the island. Albizu Campos knew this, and he put forward a two-stage plan for the uprising, which would ultimately bring them to the town. After the initial wave of revolts, revolutionaries were to congregate in Utuado and hold the town at all hazard in the hopes of drumming up international support for Puerto Rican independence. The largest assault squad was assembled for this uprising. 32 nationalists had gathered around the town on October 30th. Unfortunately for them, FBI informants had compromised the uprising before it even began. The first assault on the federal post office was met with no resistance by authorities, and the nationalists succeeded in setting fire to the building. Their attack on the insular police office did not go as smoothly. Officers were barricaded and waiting for the nationalists with snipers. In the firefight, several nationalists were shot, and they retreated to the house of the local president of the Nationalist Party. The house was, in turn, fired on by authorities for over 2 hours. Police attempted to storm the house, but were met with determined resistance and were eventually forced to withdraw. At 8 p.m. that night, 1,000 National Guardsmen occupied Utuado. They deployed a 50-caliber machine gun to a gas station, which had a clear view of the house the Nationalists were holding. The gun fired 600 rounds a minute for over 5 minutes, and the structural integrity of the house began to give way. At 11:30 p.m., they let loose again. This time, they didn't stop shooting until 5,000 rounds of ammunition eviscerated what was left of the home. Amongst the rubble was the Nationalist leader who had been killed in this final barrage. The guardsmen called on the Nationalists still alive to surrender within 5 minutes, and no harm would come to them. If they didn't, the guardsmen promised to grenade the house until no one was left alive. The Nationalists complied. 9 survivors were taken out of the house at bayonet point, and they were led to the police station. Just outside, a Browning machine gun was deployed facing a wall. The men were lined up against the wall, and one officer said, quote, "You won't be killing any policemen anymore," unquote. All at once, the machine gun opened up on the 9 unarmed men. Antonio Ramos died instantly when he was shot through the head. Agustin Quiñones Mercado had his legs ripped apart. Antonio Gonzalez was bleeding to death, and he began begging his executioners for water. One guardsman shouted, quote, "You want water?" unquote, as he stabbed him in the chest with his bayonet. Feliciano Calon died writing "assassins" in his own blood on the pavement. This upset the guardsmen, and they had the word erased, but they left the bodies to rot for hours. In total, 5 of the Nationalists died in the butchery. The other 4 were maimed physically and emotionally for life. There were also several smaller uprisings in Arecibo, Mayagüez, Ponce, and Naranjito, but they were each more disorganized than the last. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, "Everything happened too early or too late," unquote. Arecibo's cell began the revolution too early, in spite of being met with initial success. Nationalists killed 4 policemen in their attack on the local station, but failed to capture the building. One Nationalist was killed covering the retreat of his comrades. In Mayagüez, the uprising began too late. By the time Nationalists arrived at the police station, authorities had been prepared for the assault for over 2 hours. The Nationalists retreated in haste and soon took up positions in the mountains. In Ponce, a small group of Nationalists attempted to seize a cement factory, but they were stopped by police. A gunfight ensued, resulting in the death of one police officer. Of all these small-scale uprisings, the most successful was in Naranjito. Nationalists got nowhere in their initial assault on the local police station. However, upon their retreat into the mountains, a World War II veteran took up the reins of leadership and waged a highly successful guerrilla campaign against authorities for over a week. After finally surrendering, the veteran was asked why he fought for so long, knowing that it was fruitless. And he responded, quote, "Because giving up was not our mission. We were trying to bring international attention to Puerto Rico," unquote. In San Juan, there was an attempted kidnapping of Luis Muñoz Marin, which was led by a small but determined group of Nationalists. 5 men were tasked with the dangerous assignment. they quickly noticed that all along their fateful ride to La Fortaleza, the governor's mansion, snipers and armed police were placed in strategic locations. It was clear to them that they probably wouldn't return home alive, but they continued their final ride. Raimundo Pacheco, the former head of the Revolutionary Army, now disgraced after his brother was discovered to be an FBI informant, led the attack. The group's plan was relatively simple. They were to storm the governor's mansion, find him, and threaten to kill him. From there, they would demand Puerto Rican independence, and if necessary, they were prepared to kill the governor. The squad rolled into the entrance of La Fortaleza when the first shot struck the driver in the temple. Raimundo Pacheco exited the car, firing 2 submachine guns at armed guards. He wounded 2 of them and shot a spray of bullets into the second floor, where Muñoz Marin resided. Pacheco ran behind a palm tree, where a hidden sniper killed him with a single bullet. Jumping out of the back right seat, Roberto Acevedo Quiñones was spraying fire in all directions. He ran about 20 feet from the car and was killed, his body hitting the pavement with a loud thud. Out of the rear left passenger seat, Manuel Torres Medina circled around the right to get a clear view of potential targets. He too was killed almost instantly. The driver, Domingo Giraldo, was badly wounded in the initial fire, but he managed to crawl to a wall where he propped his body up. Officers approached him and he cried, quote, "I'm already dead, please don't shoot me anymore," unquote. Officers shot him again, killing him. The only survivor was Gregorio Hernandez. He managed to shimmy underneath the car and traded bullets with authorities for over an hour. When he had finally passed out from blood loss, authorities discovered he had sustained 19 bullet wounds and 5 bullets were still inside him. Pedro Albizu Campos was 6 blocks away in his apartment. It was besieged by National Guardsmen who had placed the entire building in a deadly machine gun crossfire. Efrain Lopez Corchado was killed by authorities when he attempted to enter the apartment. Albizu Campos was building a wall of every book he owned in order to protect himself from the whizzing bullets. Doris Teresola was amongst the people inside the apartment. She had a bullet tear into her throat. Albizu Campos ordered 2 men with him to take her body out and seek medical aid. The 2 escorts and Teresola were arrested upon leaving the building. Albizu Campos spent the night trading shots with police. At some point during the day's commotion, a nationalist named Alvaro Rivera Walker managed to slip into Albizu Campos' apartment. Called on to parley, Albizu Campos demanded to know the condition of Teresola, but received no answer from the chief of police. Instead, the chief of police tossed up a newspaper listing all the names of nationalists who had been killed in the past few days of fighting. The headline was a quote from President Truman calling the entire revolution, quote, "an incident between Puerto Ricans," unquote. Bewildered at the news and the lack of serious reporting from the American media, Albizu Campos asked, quote, "Are we invisible?" unquote. To which Alvaro responded, quote, "God saw them," unquote. The next day, November 1, 1950, the Puerto Rican Revolution would be brought to Washington, D.C. It was an unusually hot November day. The Trumans were staying in Blair House in 1651 Pennsylvania Avenue because the White House was undergoing renovations. Truman had no way of knowing that 2 Puerto Ricans, Griselio Teresola and Oscar Collazo, were mere blocks away and intent on killing him. They were going to attempt to kill the president in order to prove to the entire United States that Puerto Ricans weren't ghosts, that they were real people with real motivations, hopes, and agency. The 2 understood clearly they would likely not be returning alive from their endeavor, especially if they were successful in assassinating Truman. they had surprise on their side, as the assassination attempt was planned in complete secrecy and only discussed by a select few. Both would-be assassins were dressed in their Sunday best, as they exited a taxi on the corner of 15th Street and Pennsylvania Avenue. It was 2:12 p.m. They approached Blair House from two separate directions, each of them carrying Walther P-38 pistols. Immediately, there were issues, as Collazo's gun jammed. Torresola, whose sister had been shot in the throat the day previous, took the initiative and shot a guard, who later died, before running to the Blair House entrance. In a matter of moments, both sides delivered more than 100 rounds of ammunition. At one point, Truman looked out his window and saw Torresola loading his weapon. If Truman had looked out his window a moment before or after, he may well have been killed. Before Torresola could reload, however, a bullet passed through his head and killed him instantly. Collazo was taken into custody. This was the first conspiracy to kill a president since John Wilkes Booth had assassinated Abraham Lincoln. Back in Puerto Rico, the once steady business of the Salon Boricua had fallen off a cliff. Anyone who entered the barber shop was arrested upon exiting. The only saving grace for Santiago Diaz was that authorities failed to discover the cache of weapons he had stored next door, nor the false panel in the bathroom, which led to the same empty apartment. The same day the attempt was made on Truman's life, Santiago Diaz was praying. He begged the statue of Santa Barbara for guidance when he noticed an army truck roll up in front of his establishment. Over a dozen heavily armed men exited the truck, and all at once, Santiago Diaz knew what he had to do. Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, "He turned the radio up loud, ran into the bathroom, and slammed the door. Then he opened the hidden panel, plunged into the next door basement, and grabbed a box full of weapons. Within 5 minutes, he'd scooped up two more boxes and brought them into the barber shop." Unquote. He set about placing shotguns and revolvers in strategic locations around the shop. Behind a concrete column, he placed Molotov cocktails, a submachine gun, and 40 magazines of bullets. After this haphazard deployment of weaponry, the bell above his door rang, and an insular police officer entered the shop. Santiago Diaz asked if he could help the man, and then fired a round in his general direction. The officer scurried out of the barber shop quickly, and a rain of bullets fell on Santiago Diaz's position. He took a deep breath and responded with 20 rounds from his M3A1 submachine gun. The National Guardsmen quickly ducked for cover. They were clearly not expecting return fire, let alone the fire of a military-grade weapon. Following this burst of fire, Santiago Diaz made a mad rush upstairs. He chucked a Molotov cocktail out the window with all his might. The cocktail hit a police car, which caught fire and sent cops and soldiers scattering in all directions. He tossed a second cocktail, which made direct contact with a National Guard jeep. Running to a third window, Santiago Diaz let off another spray of bullets onto the surrounding rooftops. The authorities were done playing around, and they lit up the salon. In this exchange, Santiago Diaz was hit by a bullet in the leg. As his life's work collapsed around him, he couldn't help but laugh at the apt choice of musical accompaniment on his personal radio. The song, "If I'd Have Known You Were Coming, I Would Have Baked You a Cake," played throughout the barbershop as Santiago Diaz attempted to stymie the bleeding of his leg wound. Due to Santiago Diaz's rapid movement, National Guardsmen believed they were actually facing off against 30 highly armed nationalists. As a result, the shootout at the shop was being broadcast all across the island. The National Guard was being embarrassed, and they needed to quickly rectify the situation. They called up more reinforcements and deployed machine guns and bazooka teams for action. A local reporter attempted to converse with Santiago Diaz, who was still barricaded in his shop. He told the reporter he was, quote, all fucked up, unquote. Then the firing by authorities began, and the Salon Boricua was ripped to pieces by thousands of bullets. Police were preparing to storm the building when Santiago Diaz appeared at what was left of the doorway and fired hot lead at any policeman or National Guardsman he could see. Authorities responded with a bazooka shell, which exploded inside the barbershop. Once more, authorities attempted to negotiate. They demanded Santiago Diaz and, quote, all the other nationalists barricaded inside with him, unquote, surrender. Diaz responded that it was just him. Authorities told Santiago Diaz that he had 1 minute to leave the barbershop or die. Santiago Diaz was done talking, and he chucked three more Molotov cocktails out the window. Authorities opened fire once more on what was left of the shop. The concrete pillar behind the shoeshine stand was the only refuge left. The battle raged for another hour, with Santiago Diaz being hit four times and losing three fingers and a chunk of his cheek. But he continued fighting like a man possessed. At one point, Santiago Diaz began singing a traditional Christmas hymn with his own lyrics. He finished each verse with a pistol blast. He sang, quote, I have a pistol with a marble handle to kill all the Yankees who come by railroad, unquote. Eventually, the building gave out and buried Santiago Diaz in the rubble. Soldiers rushed the remains of the building and discovered his body covered in blood and debris. For good measure, one guardsman shot Santiago Diaz in the head to make sure that he was dead. They dragged his body from underneath the rubble when something terrifying happened. Santiago Diaz opened his eyes. He was still very much alive. By some miracle, the bullet had not killed him. Nelson A. Dennis concludes, quote, he was a barber who stood up to an empire with a bullet in his brain, unquote. Following the revolution, Luis Muñoz Marín declared martial law throughout the island and police crackdowns followed. Thousands of suspected nationalists were rounded up and the seeds of misinformation were sown by the powers that be. They claimed Haiwai was, quote, destroyed by nationalists, unquote. Apparently, the 500-pound bombs from jet fighters had nothing to do with it. They said the nationalists were in league with communists and that the party was funded by the Soviet Union. Soldiers and police arrested thousands of men, women, the elderly, and children. Charges were handed down which were brutal and draconian. Doris Torresola, for example, got 10 years imprisonment for daring to be shot in the throat. Others got 5 years or more for possessing Puerto Rican flags. It was an intolerable level of police repression. Many nationalists were held without bail and without charges. They were subjected to bright lights in their cells 24/7, given no sheets or towels, and not allowed to consult lawyers or see family members. This treatment, although heinous, was nothing like that which occurred at La Princesa, an old Spanish fort in San Juan. It was here where nationalist leaders were held and where the human spirit was broken by some of the most sadistic jailers in history. One room was called La Casa de Chincas, or the Bedbug Box. As you might have guessed, this was a room which was infested with bedbugs. Those who misbehaved were stripped and thrown into this room, where the hungry bedbugs would assault the prisoner in their thousands. At first, the prisoner would resist and kill many, but eventually his will would break and he would allow the bugs to feast on his body. Besides clear signs of physical torture, mental torture was used to break the most recalcitrant. Heriberto Marín Torres was told he was being released. On the supposed day, he was brought before FBI agents who claimed his mother was dying and that she would probably recover if he was by her side. All they needed was the information Torres supposedly had, and he could walk free. He refused and was sent back to his cell, completely deflated and denied his promised release. Justo Guzman Serrano's mother did die, but he was refused the ability to attend the funeral by the U.S. State Department. The funeral procession was redirected to pass by the prison where Serrano was able to say goodbye to his mother, albeit from inside a cell. The only survivor of the Fortaleza attack was treated much more cruelly. Finally allowed to see his wife, he asked a million questions about their daughter. Unfortunately, the child had passed away, and the guards had intentionally thrown away the letter. Duiste Dit Marrero had nothing to do with the revolt, but he was a socialist and that was good enough for the authorities. He was charged with conspiracy to overthrow the government of the United States. The severity of these charges shocked him and his wife, who committed suicide following his imprisonment. Upon discovering her death, Marrero lost his mind and took his own life as well. Francisco Matos Pauli was a poet whose only crime was possessing a nationalist flag. This garnered him over 20 years in prison. The warden intentionally deprived him of writing utensils, but this did not stop Pauli from covering his cell wall with poetry, much to the warden's chagrin. Following his release, Pauli would become a Nobel laureate in 1977. Albizu Campos, meanwhile, had a specially designed cell, which was located close to the medical ward. For 6 months, Albizu Campos was subjected to complete solitary confinement. In early 1951, rumors began swirling of a quote-unquote death machine, which was slowly killing people in La Princesa. Months before his trial, Albizu Campos began complaining of strange lights being broadcast into his cell. These rays of light were so intense they made Albizu Campos pass out. When he awoke, he claimed to have a splitting headache and what felt like a full-body sunburn. Within a week, Albizu Campos' hands, arms, and legs began to swell whenever he was supposedly hit with these strange lights. These same areas also exhibited burns which Albizu Campos claimed were the result of intentional irradiation by authorities. Brought to trial in August 1951, Albizu Campos was quickly convicted and sentenced to life imprisonment. Brought in to study and examine Albizu Campos, a group of psychiatrists refused to pass judgment on his physical ailments, but claimed Albizu Campos was suffering from, quote, an interpretive psychosis of injury and danger, unquote, while also asserting he suffered from, quote, overtones of paranoia, unquote. Few American papers took Albizu Campos's claim seriously, but one Argentinian newspaper called this a, quote, atomic lynching, unquote. The only recourse Albizu Campos had was to cover his head with wet towels in the hopes of stemming the spread of the radiation. Guards took to calling him the Knight of the Towels because of this. Later that year, Dr. Orlando Daomi conducted an independent examination of Albizu Campos and came up with the following conclusions. Quote, 1. The sores on Albizu Campos were produced by radiation burns. 2. His symptoms corresponded to those of a person who had received intense radiation. And 3. Wrapping himself in wet towels was the best way to diminish the intensity of the radiation. Unquote. Thanks to international pressure, Muñoz Marín officially pardoned Albizu Campos in 1953. Once out, friends approached him with a Geiger counter, an instrument which measures radiation. When they pressed the device to Albizu Campos' skin, the machine broke. Once out, Albizu Campos couldn't help but conspire once more for the liberation of Puerto Rico. He had tried the democratic method for years, attempted an uprising in Puerto Rico, and helped promote an assassination attempt on the United States president. Now, Albizu Campos would take the fight for Puerto Rican independence straight to the halls of Congress. On March 1, 1954, four nationalists led by Lolita Lebron had just arrived in Washington, D.C. They were attending a session of the House of Representatives, watching from the visitors' gallery. On Lebron's order, the Puerto Rican flag was unfurled, and she yelled, quote, Viva Puerto Rico Libre, unquote, or Long Live a Free Puerto Rico. Then the other nationalists began firing pistols into the session of the House. Five representatives in total were wounded, with Alvin M. Bentley being severely wounded by a bullet in the chest. The reaction was swift. Once more, Albizu Campos' apartment was besieged by the authorities until he surrendered himself. This time he was not going to escape, and the authorities made sure of it. He was sent to prison for the last time, and in March of 1956, he suffered a massive stroke. Authorities refused to send him to a hospital for over 48 hours. In that time, Albizu Campos lost all feeling in the right side of his body, and he was never able to speak again. Albizu Campos was forced into silence for good. He would never again be able to enrapture audiences with his incendiary speeches and staccato delivery. In 1965, he was transferred to a hospital, where he died later that year. The question remains, did the United States intentionally radiate a man to death? The answer can help clear up decades of debate. If it is the case that Albizu Campos was intentionally irradiated by American authorities, it would prove many of his complaints about American overlordship. If he wasn't, this would deflate the cause of Puerto Rican independence. We know America has no qualms with experimenting and irradiating its own soldiers. In the 1980s, a report by the House Committee on Energy and Commerce, titled, quote, American Nuclear Guinea Pigs, unquote, gave proof of this fact. 10 years later, they released another report detailing America's use of radiation on, quote, children, mental patients, mentally disabled people, and prison inmates, unquote. In total, over 20,000 people were intentionally irradiated by the American government from the start of World War II through the mid-1970s. In many cases, experimentation was kept secret from victims, and those who were aware that they were being experimented on were sworn to absolute secrecy. Many only revealed that they had been living science experiments on their deathbeds. In the most horrifying case, disabled children in Massachusetts were told they were joining a quote-unquote science club, only to be fed radioactive lunches for a decade. With the information we have available, Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, it is possible Albizu Campos was one of the 20,000 people subjected to radiation experimentation, unquote. The FBI admitted Albizu Campos suffered from a litany of radiation-like symptoms, which included swollen legs, high blood pressure, and sores all over his body. When independent physicians were brought in to examine Albizu Campos, the FBI would launch a full-on investigation into the doctor's personal lives. Through the release of declassified documents, we now know that a government radiologist was brought in to examine Albizu Campos in 1951. This same radiologist built two devices, which emitted medium exposure and low exposure levels of radiation. His company was funded by the U.S. Army and NASA to study the effects of differing doses of radiation on humans. Concurrently, Nelson A. Dennis says the U.S. Department of Defense awarded the Sloan Kettering Institute of New York a multi-million-dollar contract, quote, to study post-irradiation syndrome in humans, unquote. Who was in charge of this prestigious institute? Why, none other than Cornelius P. Rhodes, the doctor who is alleged to have killed 8 Puerto Ricans with radiation poisoning. let us now present the case against Albiz Ocampos, largely supported by American authorities. They claim that since Albiz Ocampos complained of being irradiated, then he must be crazy. They brought in countless psychiatrists and mental health professionals to confirm their hypothesis. They all agreed Albiz Ocampos was quote-unquote paranoid. They never performed a physical assessment on the many unexplained burns on his body, and they never deemed it necessary to explain them. In summation, Nelson A. Dennis says, quote, "It is difficult to escape the conclusion that Albizo was one of 20,000 U.S. citizens treated as little more than lab rats. In Albizo's case, it finally killed him," unquote. Regardless of Albiz Ocampos' controversial legacy, he fought tirelessly for Puerto Ricans until the government silenced him for good. He inspired millions of Puerto Ricans to seek better treatment. Beyond this, he inspired revolutionaries all across Latin America. Ernesto Che Guevara, a controversial figure in his own right, said, quote, "Albiz Ocampos is a symbol of the yet unfree but indomitable Latin America. Years and years of prison, almost unbearable pressures in jail, mental torture, solitude, total isolation from his people and his family, the insolence of the conqueror and its lackeys in the land of his birth. Nothing broke his will," unquote. Upon his death, 100,000 Puerto Ricans passed by his body over the course of 3 days of mourning. The death of Albiz Ocampos was a true turning point in the island's history. Since his passing, the island's leaders have not been able to so aptly put into words the grievances of Puerto Ricans who clamor for independence. A few months before the revolution, Truman signed Public Law 600 into being. It set Puerto Rico on the road to forging its own constitution, which would have to be approved by Congress. Fernando Pico says the law required, quote, "any amendment to the Constitution to be consistent with the Constitution of the United States," unquote. It was a law which was campaigned and lobbied for by pro-statehood conservatives as a way to keep the island in the running for statehood in the future. The law went before the Puerto Rican electorate in the form of a referendum. Over 300,000 Puerto Ricans voted to support the initiative. Having a clear majority in the legislature, the Progressive PPD, or the Popular Democratic Party, had 70 delegates assigned to the Puerto Rican Constitutional Convention. Alongside them were 20-odd pro-staters led by Luis A. Ferre, who was a well-known industrialist in Puerto Rico who used his platform to catapult himself into politics. Arturo Morales Carrion called the resulting constitution, quote, "a very progressive and widely praised document, which asserted Puerto Rico's natural rights and its commitment to the democratic system and human rights, as well as its loyalty to the principle of the federal constitution and the idea of a compact with the United States," unquote. The constitution would not exclude the development of independence or some sort of autonomous state, so long as it stuck within the parameters of union with the United States. This ushered in the era of the Estado Libre Asociado, or Free Associated State, or the Commonwealth. There was much resentment and opposition to the new constitution from Puerto Rico and from the U.S. Congress. Vito Marcantonio, a socialist delegate from East Harlem, was against the compact because he supported Puerto Rican independence. Conservative Southerners opposed the bill as well. They felt Puerto Rican politics were drifting dangerously close to socialism, and they wished to rein in this radical streak on the island. Congress, unfortunately, had final say in Puerto Rico's constitution. So their opposition would prove crucial in neutering aspects of the document of which they disapproved. Most of the opposition was unsurprisingly racist. Ollie Johnson of South Carolina believed Puerto Rico was a, quote, giant incubator for peoples who often do not understand American traditions and ideals, unquote. Eventually, in spite of many misgivings, the Constitution was agreed on by the majority of Congress, whether these misgivings were correct or corrosive. Following the flag-raising ceremony in 1952, the gag law was modified. Now, you could possess a Puerto Rican flag, but aspects of the law remained in force until 1957. Following the Revolution, the house shooting, and the Korean War, Puerto Rico started in 1955 what Fernando Pico called the quote-unquote peaceful decade. Alongside relatively peaceful politics, there was economic success. Operation Bootstrap was having a serious impact on the Puerto Rican economy. Tens of thousands were employed on the island, but the companies which employed Puerto Ricans usually funneled the profits they made on the island back to the mainland. Amongst these companies, there was an early petrochemical industrial boom, as well as huge investments from pharmaceutical companies. In Barceloneta, for example, the town gained the nickname Ciudad Viagra because of the massive Viagra plant in the town. Beyond this, Pepsi set up bottling facilities on the island, and glass companies began utilizing Puerto Rican sand to such an extent that the island is now suffering from a sand deficit. Besides the revolutionary attempts to make Puerto Rico independent, there were active attempts to free the island politically. The PIP, or Puerto Rican Independence Party, was a strong third force in politics. They polled as many as 100,000 votes at their zenith, but today they usually poll in the low thousands. Their party has no true political allegiance, and its membership ranges from Marxist-Leninists to far-right Catholics. Government repression of independentistas and nationalists no doubt contributed to the fall in popularity. But overall, Puerto Ricans settled into a two-party system similar to the United States, with the Republicans on one side and the PPD on the other. On the outside looking in were the socialists, who had been relegated out of the classic coalition with the Republicans, and likewise suffered from government crackdowns. Beyond political oppression, the ideals of the Socialist Party had been largely co-opted by the PPD, which rallied all segments of society from the left and center of the political spectrum. Changes in the countryside were undeniable. Schools were active in all parts of the island, and the citizens enjoyed island-wide electricity. In 1955, the Institute of Puerto Rican Culture was founded. Ricardo Alegría was named as the first president. He made it a priority to research the Taíno civilization which had originally existed on the island, funding countless digs and excavations in the few areas where an archaeological dig was still possible. Much like the United States during the same time, people began to feel that a quote-unquote peaceful revolution was possible. The United States turned Puerto Rico into a large outpost for liberal democracy in the entire Caribbean region. As a result, countless dissidents from authoritarian states found a home in Puerto Rico. This included intellectuals and artists fleeing authoritarian right-wing regimes and communist states as well. Amongst them was the Catalan cellist Pablo Casals, who was sponsored by the state to host the Casals Festival, an internationally recognized classic music festival. Tourists from the mainland followed these initiatives, and Puerto Rico became a go-to spot for yuppies all across America. This trend hit its peak in 1980, when almost 1 million tourists were registered at hotels in Puerto Rico. Running concurrently with rapid industrialization, urbanization began to ramp up in a major way. By 1980, over 1 million Puerto Ricans owned a motor vehicle. Malls replaced old mom-and-pop shops as American fashion sense and culture began to saturate the island. Things began to slowly change for Puerto Rican women as well. There was still rampant misogyny and instances of sexual assault and violence, but they began to ebb in this period. Puerto Rican women like Margo Asre and Concha Meléndez began a renaissance of Puerto Rican poetry at the University of Puerto Rico. In politics, the transition to a fairer society between men and women was much slower. It was not until 2000 that a Puerto Rican woman was chosen to lead the island as the governor. Besides clear signs of progress, Puerto Rico was in no way fixed. Poverty was still rampant. Wages were incredibly poor, and unions took direction from their mainland chapters. The island was considered overpopulated, and for its time it was. There were 650 inhabitants per square mile on the island. Comparatively, Singapore today is home to 20,000 people per square mile. As we have seen, Americans have been attempting to solve the population problem through humane and inhumane methods alike. The mass migration of Puerto Ricans, stimulated by the island's government, seemed the simplest, easiest, and most profitable course of action. These new migrants arrived in America and created a ready and willing lower middle class, which was prepared to work almost any job to make ends meet. Another method, which was favored by authorities, was the ready access to birth control for Puerto Rican women. Across America, quote-unquote blue-nose brigades cracked down on women who used birth control, but in Puerto Rico, it was endorsed by conservatives as a way of keeping the quote-unquote backward population in check. The early founder of Planned Parenthood supported this enthusiastically, and Puerto Rico became home to the first trials of the pill, which was eventually accepted by the FDA in 1960. During this time, Puerto Rico became a laboratory once more, and it was one of the many reasons which contributed to the 1950 revolution. All of these factors contributed to the fact that the great migration of Puerto Ricans to America was led primarily by women. One of the hundreds of thousands of women who left the island was my abuela, who later became the only Spanish-speaking secretary in Nelson Rockefeller's office. The violence and rapid changes on the island were never correctly documented in the United States media. Instead, America's sensationalist media and conservative fear-mongers created a moral panic, focusing on Puerto Rican youths. They claimed Puerto Ricans were, quote, committing crimes, joining gangs, and smoking the devil's lettuce, unquote, at ever-increasing rates. In reality, Puerto Rican teenagers, like Mexican immigrants today, committed less crime than the average New Yorker. This stereotype was reinforced in numerous high-profile New York City crimes and in biased media portrayals. It began with sleazy dime store novels like The Young Savages and Run, Chicago, Run. In no time at all, serious plays like 12 Angry Men were depicting Puerto Rican teenagers as possible murderers. Although, to be clear, 12 Angry Men takes a positive position on the accused. By far, one of the most famous depictions of Puerto Ricans is the musical West Side Story. The play, which was originally called Gang Bang, first starred rival Jewish and Catholic gangs, but Puerto Ricans were substituted for their Jewish counterparts as they were, quote, more trendy, unquote. At first, Stephen Sondheim, the show's lyricist, demurred taking the job. He said, quote, I've never even known a Puerto Rican, unquote. Eventually, Sondheim would accept the role and lean into every single stereotype and prejudice with which Puerto Ricans had been tarnished. In the song America, Sondheim describes the Puerto Rican island as quote-unquote ugly, with quote, tropic diseases, hurricanes blowing, and population growing, unquote. The musical is essentially an adaptation of Romeo and Juliet, just add switchblades. It became so popular that a movie was adapted from it, which spawned a recent remake directed by Steven Spielberg. It remains one of the few depictions of Puerto Ricans in the media, and is usually the first exposure many receive to the island's people. One of the few true lines in the entire musical is, quote, "Nobody knows in America, Puerto Rico's in America," unquote. In 1959, people began to see the first signs that the decade of peace was ending. Fidel Castro, alongside Che Guevara and 500 poorly armed revolutionaries, succeeded in collapsing the government of Cuba. A socialist state was declared, and land was nationalized and redistributed to the peasantry. Many on the island supported the Cuban Revolution and dreamed for the day when their island was free as well. Conservatives, however, believed the revolution boded ill tidings for the future of the region and the false peace which reigned. The 1960s began with the election of John F. Kennedy and the continued success of the PPD. Kennedy liked the people of Puerto Rico and became fast friends with Luis Muñoz Marín. When JFK arrived on the island, over 700,000 people came out to greet him. In 1963, Kennedy awarded Marín the Presidential Medal of Freedom. That same year, however, JFK was assassinated, and relations between the island and the mainland grew tense once more. Muñoz Marín had been in charge for over a decade at this point, and he grew tired of heading the ship of state. He endeavored to make the transition to his chosen successor's leadership as seamless as possible. He called for a 6-point program future governors should attempt to mirror. Arturo Morales Carrion said the program included, quote, "quality education for all, the best of health care, a home for every family, an orderly balance between rural and urban life, increased economic activity in the hands of Puerto Ricans, and the abolition of extreme poverty," unquote. The Secretary of State, Robert Sanchez Vilella, was handpicked to succeed Marín. Many centrist members of the PPD saw this as a grave mistake, as they were concerned with Vieira's leftist rhetoric. Meanwhile, in Southeast Asia, American forces had been slowly escalating a war with South Vietnamese guerrillas, as well as regular NVA, North Vietnamese Army, units. Inventing a false flag attack, which he claimed to have occurred in the Gulf of Tonkin, Lyndon B. Johnson vastly increased America's presence in the area. Soon, tens of thousands of Puerto Ricans would be called on, once more, to serve the country that constantly belittled and harmed them. The selection of Vilella began a rapid decline in the fortunes of the PPD, as his style alienated many. Opposing the PPD, Luis Ferré was bolstering conservative elements on the island and pushing for a plebiscite on the question of the island's status. In 1967, over 60% of Puerto Rican voters supported the Commonwealth, while almost 40% supported statehood. Most independence groups boycotted the plebiscite. The results were shocking, in that the statehood option was able to rally so much support. It showed people were dissatisfied with the current state of affairs. Luis Ferré capitalized on this momentum and created a new political party, the New Progressive Party, or NPP. In spite of its name, the party aligned more to the center-right and had many conservative contacts in Washington. The PPD became rife with factionalism. Vilella became so hated amongst his own party's leadership that he was denied the nomination for the 1968 election. As a result, he split from the PPD and formed the People's Party, which he claimed espoused the quote-unquote true ideals of the PPD. This splinter group proved decisive for the 1968 election. The newly formed NPP won out by a slim 20,000 vote margin. The PPD was a close second, while the People's Party played a decisive spoiler role, gaining over 80,000 votes. The perennial last place party was the PIP, who failed to gain more than 25,000 votes. Luis Ferré's election victory proved a landmark in Puerto Rican history. There was a clear change happening all across the island. The boom of the post-Korean War was fading rapidly, and in its place, a new normal was being shaped by an increased use in government programs, the creep of Wall Street speculation, and the promise of economic stagnation and political bitterness. To hear how Puerto Rico forged its way into the present day, you'll have to wait for the next episode of Turning Tides. We will cover the rise of neoliberal economic policy, the trash fire that was the Trump presidency, and the search for a better solution which will help all Puerto Ricans. Thank you for listening. I'm your host, Joseph Pascone. Before we finish up today, I'd like to share a poem written by Pedro Pietri called Puerto Rican Obituary. He writes, quote, "They worked. They were always on time. They were never late. They never spoke back. When they were insulted, they worked. They never went on strike without permission. They never took days off that were on the calendar. They worked 10 days a week and were only paid for 5. They worked. They worked. They worked. And they died. They died broke. They died owing. They never died knowing what the front entrance of the First National Bank looks like."
If you like what you heard today, you can support us by donating on PayPal at Turning Tides Podcast 1. Thanks for the support and thank you for listening. If you like what you've heard, we'd really appreciate it if you take the time to rate and review Turning Tides on whatever platform you use to listen and share the show on social media. It really helps us to bring the show to more listeners. Thank you guys so much. Thank you to everyone for listening. We'd also like to say thank you to Movo Photo. We use their sound equipment for this podcast, as well as all of our other projects at Antics Entertainment. They make great equipment at great prices, and we really appreciate that they make content creating so accessible for indie creators like us. Check them out on social media at Movo Photo, MOVOPHOTO. Thank you again.